I'm looking for Obadiah. I know it was here somewhere. Man, I don't know if I want to answer that right now, David. I tell you what. I think there's probably... Yeah, I'm just kidding about the other. The difficulty is trying to get through Obadiah here, and I really, it's not an issue that we get into on a test, which I know, you know, I'm not saying that everybody just asks questions just because they're afraid of the test. But I'd be glad to talk about that maybe on a more private basis. Is that sufficient for everyone? I mean, it's something we could spend hours on, all the speculation points, but if we're going to get through all these minor prophets, I probably better not go over it again. You know, the basic things that I would have you remember from that, though, is the aspect of what the 1260 days covers, that first part, which is the overlap.
I mean, I'll sit here and talk about it and then wonder what's happening. There are certain things that overlap here. Now, did I give out a handout on this on the 1260, 1290, and 1335 class? I guess I did that in biblical prophecy one year. You'll get it more in biblical prophecy. But you have in Revelation 11, you have the Gentiles dominating the city. And in the first couple of verses, what does it say there? Is it 42 months? I don't remember the exact figures there. Is that where it says 1260 days? Can I have a Bible open real quick? Look up a Revelation 11, the first phrase there.
It says 42 months.
Okay, so we've got 42 months. Then we have, later in the chapter, what, about verse 3, Jeff, or whatever, does it talk about the two witnesses? Does it give another time period for them?
1260 days.
Okay, so we've got 1260 days. For the two witnesses. Again, this is Revelation chapter 11. So this is concurrent. We then tie in Revelation 12. And what is it? Verse 14. Where it talks about the church in safety. Her place. And there it says time, which is singular, times, which is plural, and a half. So minimum, this is 3.5. So happens it corresponds with these others, and therefore we believe it is the minimum time, 3.5. Okay. These are all corresponding, they all end in Christ's return. When you look at Matthew 24 and Luke 21, it talks about beware when you see the army circling Jerusalem to get out because the war is imminent. In Daniel chapter 12, it talks about 1290 days. If, and I underline the word if, the 1290 days ends with the return of Christ, which almost all prophecy ends with the return of Christ. When we're talking about the day of the Lord, the great tribulation, we're talking about all the terrible things that happens to mankind, it all focuses on Christ's return. Therefore, we believe that the 1290 days then focuses on that time period. Here would be an additional 30 that ties in with the 1260 that leads to Christ's return. So, we see events that will take place as Europe unites, as the Catholic Church would then become dominant, as there may be then the amalgamation of Protestant churches that would lead to this event of the army surrounding Jerusalem. Before that, we have other events that would lead to that. You know, so, you know, as I listed, we've got the beast powers growing. We've got the Catholic Church.
Are we going to find the right one here soon? What are we trying to do? Keep me from being able to read the board so that I'll quit or what? I can't see anything. It was fine there for a while.
You want to back up?
Yeah, that way I can see what I'm doing. I know it doesn't look like I know what I'm doing, you know, it's my handwriting and whatever. But then I'm doing this off the top of my head, so. The Beast, the Catholic Church uniting, and then dominating the Beast, so there's two aspects there. We would find the question of the altar, so therefore the concept of Judaism and them getting the strength to have an altar for sacrifices. I mean, there are many factors that we look at, things to happen, and we're talking back here now, for the sacrifices then finally to stop. And eventually, we believe there will be a famine of the word. Amos 8, verse 11. See, now that I'm taking the time in class to do this, now I can ask it on the test. Amos 8, verse 11. That there will be a time period of famine of the word. We know in Daniel. And so, Daniel 12, it says, blessed is he who waits the 1,335 days. Which would be an additional 45 days before the 1,290, which is 30 before the 1,260. Is that one of the key things that will happen that will help us to know that the time period of the armies to come is soon? I don't know. That's a big if at that point. Famine of the word could be a more general statement. Okay? Fair enough? Any questions on that? Yeah, someone will grab the other end of this. See how nice she was? She was concerned about those in the back, and she's up front, so obviously she can see it. So, all right. There you go. Anything else? Yes.
Yes, sir. Where do we get that time? I know it makes sense. Where do we get that time is a prophetic year? Is that something that...
The time is a prophetic year. Because of this overlap right here, I think, more than anything, that the church goes into her place. There are a couple other places, and Daniel uses the same phrase. It shall be, this shall remain for the time of the end, and then it would be understood. And he says, for a time, times, and half a time. And putting together several different scriptures that show that it's a time of Jacob's trouble, for instance. Where does it say that? Jeremiah 31:1. But just putting together the facts on the time and times and half a time that it is attacking the Philadelphian church, that we put it that way. You might also, I would look up Daniel 9, perhaps there's a phrase there too.
So in other words, in essence from here where we pull it out, so that way when we're in Daniel or other places we look at it as being prophetic here. Mm-hmm. So the time of the Gentiles and all that. Seven times.
Yes, right. The difficulty is with prophecy, there are many different ways one thing can be viewed. It's kind of like a puzzle, and you have to look and say, okay, what is possible, first of all, and then what is probable. Much of Daniel says that this is reserved for the time of the end. I mean, specifically says in the 1290 and 1335, this is reserved for the time of the end. The time of the Gentiles gets into Daniel 4 and 5. We would view their times as well as Leviticus 26 when he talks about times that there's a broader, you know, there's a broader expanse of time that is possible. Can we use times here as it's used in Daniel 4 and Daniel 5? There we use it seven times, 7 years, 360 days to a year. That ought to be 2,520 years. So we take it from 539 to 1982. Is that close?
something like that, to 1982 accomplishes the 2,520 years. Well, can you do the same thing then with the church in a place of safety while Christ, while Satan attacks the remnant of the church? In Philadelphia church, is that going to exist 2,520 years with all this no return of Christ? Well, we say obviously not. That can't be an application of that because of all the other things that tie in with Philadelphia and church and to the time of the end and whatever. Whereas then you can go the other route with it. Can times and half a time, can that be seven specific years? Well, with Nebuchadnezzar losing his sanity for seven years, yes, and that aspect is prophetic of Nebuchadnezzar losing his sanity, which is also prophetic, and this is where, again, duality is prophetic of other things. So what you do with prophecy at that point is you look at what are all the, you know, the potential aspects. And I think we have an article on many Tekla Farsi, which shows that there are other ways to figure that too, that there are so many different ways of counting that point to 2,520 years that proves the theory, you know, as far as we're concerned, of Israel and of Judah, and then the blessings being restored. So we come then to 1803 or thereabouts, and 1917. So we see 2,520 years. We see 2,520 years here. That's biblical prophecy, and you know, for those that may be in it and whatever, you know, it's a tree that's knocked over and it has the band that's put around it, and this band stays on it for these seven times. The band is loosed so that the tree can grow and develop. Used to be in the church, we taught, well, that's the Gentile nations, they will come to an end there. Which is why we looked at 1982 as the final end time. That's when the whole work's going to be over. Okay, but because this was something that was believed back in the 40s and 50s and early 60s, because I know because my wife has it written back to the Bible when she was in college, that, you know, we didn't want to wait until 1982. If that was the ultimate, then of course you could subtract the 7 years for Nebuchadnezzar's insanity, because that was already fulfilled, see? And that took care of part of the seven. And this is all logical. Therefore, we came up with 1975. This is where the date 1975 comes in as far as the figuring of prophecies in past history of the church. And of course, then you could count back to, what is that, 1972, going to a place of safety, 3.5 years before the return of Christ. And so it's all very neatly done. We had it all figured out. It just didn't work that way. So now what we believe is that all this stuff was not right, and that 1982 was the beginning of the times of the Gentiles. What is the times of the Gentiles? Used to be in the church, and you'll find maybe some literature or comments on this, which is why I spend a little bit of time on it now, that some felt, well, this is all the time the Gentiles are ruling. But had the Gentiles, were the Gentile nations ruling, dominating the world from the 1800s and the 1900s, or was Ephraim and Manasseh dominating the world? Therefore, 1982, an interesting time, if you're going to look at all the 2,000 years, the time of the beginning of the beast power to start growing. And you can look at Germany, go back and look at their history. I don't know that you're going to find some specific, you know, end issue that happened right in 1982. But since we're 9 years from that, and we're now very close to 1992, which is to be the unification of Europe, we can go back and, you know, much of the things that started towards that started in the early 80s is when they started gearing up for it. It would appear at that point then this band that took care of the tree, that you can, if you cut down a tree and you band it, it stays alive. It doesn't grow because it can't put up the shoots. But if you take a copper or brass band and tighten it, then you can leave that on for several years. When you release that band, the sap will start running through the tree, and the tree will start growing. It will stand up shoots in the inside. Now, how long does it take for that tree to get large enough that it serves and that it bears fruit? Maybe many years. So likewise, the Gentiles, and by Gentiles I mean the nations other than Israel, then start their domination, start growing towards their domination starting in 1982. So that by 1992, we will see a nation developed that has, what, 320 million people, that then as they continue to grow and to develop, and what happens with the communists, whatever, then we see what happens. But this is a readjustment of our theories that is much more in line now with what we see, what God is doing. Much of prophecy is understood not before it comes to place, but as it comes to place, as it happens. And also looking back to see what took place. Yeah, I think we've got a lot of things that we can say very dogmatically, very strongly. This is, you know, here's some things that are going to happen. We've got some dates and some times, not dates as in this is the day it happened, but some time periods that we can see. And I think when some of these things start happening even greater, and especially, you know, altar and sacrifices, when those are cut off, there's some clear prophecies in the Bible. When the armies surround Jerusalem to take Jerusalem, when the church goes to place safety, I mean, you know, hey, we got some pretty close figures to take place. It's just that we got all this other time out here we've been trying to figure everything out, and we just can't do it.
That answer your question?
Absolutely.
Good. That. We get that from the correlation here in
Revelation 11, 1260 days. If you divide that by 42, you end up, I think, with 30. Is that right? Or if you might as well divide it into it, that's 3. Yeah, 30. 30 days to a month. And therefore, we use the term a prophetic year. God's calendar, some years had more days than others. So we're not saying exactly how many days there were, what, 364 and a quarter or whatever the percentage is, whatever the fraction is at this point. But that's how it's done, and in viewing the 2520 of Israel, then, you know, we're comfortable with that. Okay, anything else?
Okay, Obadiah. And I really hope that as many of you as can next year will take biblical prophecy. I think you'll find it's a good, you know, follow-up to this. We really plan in the department to require all theology majors to take biblical prophecy, because that is the Daniel and Revelation that is kind of the background of this. You know, a lot of times I'll refer to as it says, you know, the fifth seal or the sixth seal or some of these things. I think you would find if you'd already been through Daniel and Revelation, it would, you know, be that much clearer. I'm not saying you can't do it from this avenue. I think you can do minor prophets and then go back to the other. Yeah, you can turn off those lights that are focused on me here. I thought the lights were coming from up above for the deal, but I don't like this. Get it right. Can't see a thing. That's better. Okay. Obadiah, I gave you that background as far as the covenant of brotherhood. This is really, I think, the key phrase in Obadiah is verse 10. For your violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. A spiritual message there for us that as we treat our brother, even though at times we feel our brother has mistreated us. Esau felt that Jacob had mistreated him. But God held Esau accountable for how he treated Jacob. When was the book written? Is a question that is asked. We would place it within the Assyrian section, of course, in that it is in the first six books. Therefore, we find it someplace between 850 and 700. I know that's focusing it real narrow. But 850 to 700 is the best we can do as far as, you know, being sure. Now, we might focus a little bit more carefully to about 730. 731... perhaps as a prophecy of Jehu's fall. Can't read my own writing here, I think. I think of the fall of Jerusalem, and prophetic of the fall of Jerusalem, that that would take place. Some of the traumas that were taking place to Judah during Ahaz's reign, I think we had on the handout to you, didn't we? Yeah, point number five, you might look at that, the history of Jacob and Esau. And it talks there about the conflict, the calamity, all the difficulties that were taking place. And therefore, we have stated that as a probable time of Obadiah's prophecy. You will see some charts, though, that take Obadiah all the way back to 850 with a question mark. There really is no sure way of doing it. There are others that want to try to put Obadiah after Jeremiah. Because if you will contrast Jeremiah 49, verses 14 through 16 with verses 1 through 4, they are very similar. So the question by critics is, who copied who? And then the critics of the critics bring up the fact, well, maybe both of them copied somebody else. Or maybe one God told both of them to write the same thing. I would lean towards the latter. Either that or that Jeremiah quotes Obadiah. Why do critics want to place it that late? Why do they want to place it in the, say, early 500s or 400s? Yeah, Obadiah speaks so much with such detail about things that really took place in the fall of Jerusalem and how that Edom stepped in to take the land after Judah fell and that they were a part of Nebuchadnezzar's army and all these things. They do not want to believe that God could or would prophesy those things in advance. Therefore, if you can find any kind of reason to say it came afterwards, then you can say, well, the Bible's just a lesson in history. It's another way of saying, well, how can God tell us what's going to happen in the end time and taking the book of Revelation of Daniel and putting that towards end time if the entirety of the Bible is just history couched in prophetic terms to make us think that it was prophesied? Well, that's why we do not hold to the opinions of it being after the fall of Jerusalem, but that it would be before. Obadiah starts out then with the steps and the humiliation of Esau. God is angry at Esau because of the way he has treated his brother, both personally, if we go back to the time of Esau and Jacob, as well as throughout all the ages, that the Edomites have been very antagonistic against Israel and what is commonly known as Israel today. And because of that, they're going to have to pay a penalty. Remember, Edom, closely related to Moab and of the same mind and ilk. We'll see the problem. The main problem of Edom is brought out in verse 3. The pride of your heart has deceived you. That there is a pride that those people have. I think we can see a mentality, an attitude in the Mideast and things that have taken place of late. You know, one of the big issues right now with the Iraqis leaving Kuwait, and I understand today they have determined that in the last 24, 48 hours, the Iraqis took 40,000 Kuwaitis out of Kuwait and took them up into Iraq. So whether they're going to then be hostages or how they're going to use them, that's, you know, scary. But, you know, against their own people, they're such a proud people that Hussein is trying to claim victory now. And of course, that's what galls the Western world. Then, you know, they're out to make sure that he can't claim victory and that the Arab world won't look to him. Well, I don't think there's any worry about Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait looking to him. Of course, there is a problem with Jordan, Iraq, perhaps Iran. You know, where's Syria going to fall out in this? Right now, they've been against Iraq, but don't bet that they won't then combine with Iraq after this is all over. I think Jordan has dug a very deep hole for itself by its attitude towards the war. But it's this aspect of a pride that they have to maintain their pride. It's well known in business circles. If you go to the Mideast and you're going to do any dealings with them, you have to make sure that they always feel like they've got the upper hand And you're very careful not to insult them in anything you say or anything you do, or that in itself will end the deal. So we see the steps in humiliation. Step one is found in verse 1. There's a rumor from the Eternal, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. So God sends an ambassador to stir up the nations against Edom. An ambassador. Now, I don't think there's prophetic implication here that one of you is going to be sent as the ambassador to tell them or whatever, but who knows? You know, there will be an ambassador, whether he's a graduate of Ambassador College or not, we'll see. I'm not volunteering for it, I'll guarantee you. It's sent among the heathen, arise, and let us rise up against her in battle, so the Gentile world will come against Edom. Verse 1. Verse 2, we see the second step in the humiliation. Edom is despised by other nations. So God stirs up animosity towards Edom. Point 2, Edom is despised of nations. Behold, I will make you small among the heathen. You are greatly despised. Verse 3, the pride of your heart has deceived you. You that dwell in the clefts of the rock. It was common for the Edomites back then, when they lived and possessed the land to the southeast of the Dead Sea, that they would go into the clefts of the rock. One of the major valleys they would go back into was Petra, or Petra, as it's better pronounced. And with the clefts of the rock, there's a seek that is, you know, as wide as from here to the wall. In some places, most of the places, it's more narrow than that. You can drive a pickup truck in it, but for the most part, they race Arabian horses in and out, or you walk. I felt safer walking, so I did. You know, fantastic. If you ever get the chance to be in Jordan, I don't know how many will after the episodes of late, whether we'll ever be able to take students back there, but, you know, very interesting. You know, you will hear some that visit Jordan and visit Petra that say, oh, it's just, you know, so uninhabitable, we couldn't make it, and this and that and whatever. I don't believe that. I am one of those individuals that, were you to have to go to the Mideast, you know, if that were to be the place of safety, it would be a challenge undoubtedly, and yes, there'd have to be faith in God because he'd have to provide the water. But it's been done. There's been as many as 100,000 individuals have lived in the city of, or in the valley of Petra in past times. What I find for most individuals that travel there, and this is, you know, this is just my editorial comment, take it for what it's worth. Most people go in there as the Western culture. They've just traveled to Jordan, they fly into Amman. They spend the night in Amman at the Marriott. They get up the next morning, they take a car ride down, maybe they go the desert road because it's the fastest and you don't have to mess with all this winding and, you know, Karak Castle and whatever. We always went the winding road in Karak because we want to see everything. Madaba and all those places. But they come roaring down the desert highway. They get to Petra about 11 o'clock in the day, the hottest part of the day. They hike in at that point into the Sikh, and you know, it's blistering hot. They spend 2 or 3 hours. Maybe they hike up to the, I want to say temple. That's not the word for it. Anyway, the mosque or place of worship. And then they hike back down, hot and sweaty. I mean, yeah, it's... If you did most of your work and hiking around in the heat of the day, Petra is unbearable. But if you go in, spend the night before, which is what we did, and then got up and you hike in at 7 o'clock in the morning when it's still cool, and you hike up to the high place and back down again, which takes a couple of hours, brief rest, and then you hike up to the monastery, that's the word I wanted, to the monastery and back down, and you try to get out about noon or whatever, in other words, if you were to live like an Arab lives, not like a Westerner lives, which means you would get up early in the morning, you would do any work that had to be done in the morning, you would then take siestas at noon, you go in the caves, you don't go out, you don't work out in the heat of the day, 120 degrees and whatever, and then when the sun gets low, you come out in the evening and you spend time doing, you know, whatever work you do, and you live like an Arab. Hundreds of thousands of Arabs have lived there in the past. So anyway, that's my personal heresy, that If that's where we were to go, it would be, I mean, it's beautiful. Sunsets and sun. I don't want to go there necessarily. I mean, I would prefer Vail or Hawaii or, you know, where we could be surfing instead of trying to figure out, you know, how we're going to get water and all that stuff. But my belief is wherever God wants us to be, He's going to provide the amenities, and if that's where it is, it would work. God would make it work. Let's see, we got off in Obadiah, verse 3. The clefts of the rock, they really felt like they had, that nobody could get to them. Now, in those days, it was more sure that, you know, if you could, if you had just a narrow opening on one end of the valley, which is, it's no more narrow, no more wide than this, then you can protect that. There are a couple of places where you come out of the Seek. One is a treasury building, and then you go back into a narrow decline, and then you come back out again into the valley. And it's fairly easily protected. Now, there are other entrances on the north side of the valley, but they're not as easily gotten to, and it's very difficult to come over the mountain. So they felt very safe. Now, in today's warfare and helicopters and Harrier aircraft and whatever, you know, it wouldn't be real safe. Wherever we go, God's going to have to provide the protection. And maybe it will be with the cloud as He did with Israel. You'll notice how many times, you know, how the war kind of slowed down a lot when there were the clouds, whether it was because of weather, or because it was the smoke from all the 500 oil wells that were set on fire by Hussein as he left Kuwait. Of course, peaceful intentions at all times. On his part. So anyway, they went to the clefts of the rock. They thought that they were impregnable. Arrogant, defiant, who says in his heart, "Who shall bring me down to the ground? You that exalt yourself as an eagle, and you have set your nest among the stars, thence will I bring you down," says the Eternal. So point number 3 is verses 3 and 4. God will drag them out of their impregnable fortress. They think they're so strong. God will see to it that they are drug out. And in part, that has been fulfilled in that through the ages, there were other empires that came through the Roman Empire controlled. Well, the Nabataeans came through, first of all, and kicked the Edomites out. Then the Roman Empire came in, and they got control of Petra. There have been several times that this has already been fulfilled. Does it mean that this is going to happen again in exactly this way in end time, or, you know, in general in this way in end time? I don't know. I do believe there are other prophecies in Isaiah that we'll get to that do show that at the end time, God is going to be angry at Edomites, whether they're Edomites living in that particular geographical locale or whether it's the fact that Edomites have then traveled further to the north to the land of Turkey and that area and that they stand against Israel, or if it's both. You know, it could be geographical and population-oriented together. So they're dragged out of the fortresses. Verse 5 then, he goes on to say that God is going to destroy them, that destruction is greater than thieves, that they would wish that thieves would come to get them when they compare what God is going to do. He says thieves will at least, when they go through, will leave a few grapes for you. You know, they take what they can as quickly, you know, the best of the silver and whatever, and they get out before they get caught. But he says, God's not going to leave them anything. Verse 6, how are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? Verse 7, all the men of your confederacy have brought you even to the border. The men that were at peace with you have deceived you and have prevailed against you. They that eat your bread have laid a wound unto you. There is none understanding in you. So he says these individuals are going to have some allies. Point number 5, the allies will be of no help. The allies will be of no help. To draw some parallels to what we've recently seen in Iraq, Iraq thought they had some allies. 5. 4 was God's destruction greater than the thieves. Okay? So point 5 then is the allies being of no help. I think Iraq thought they might have more of an ally, in be it Syria, Jordan. Now, Jordan, right at the end, looked to Iraq, and they were going to be an ally, and they looked to some of their soldiers to go help them and fight. Yet they kind of walked a tightrope, you know, they kind of danced around, they didn't want to get caught between the United States and Iraq. So the best of allies, God is saying, are going to be no help. They're going to break their alliance when the handwriting is then finally on the wall. I mean, Jordan doesn't want to lose its kingdom. You don't see them all of a sudden amassing all their fighters and going across the border to give up their land, if that's what it took. They eat your bread, have laid a wound unto you. There is none understanding in him. Verse 8 is then point number 6. Wise men, their counselors will fail them, even the wisdom within the land. Because nothing is to say that the Arabs are less wise than Israelis or than the Western world, except that the pride shut off the flow of blood to the brain. And therefore things are said because, you know, if I've got to be the victor, you know, sometimes you're willing to, you know, and there's a time for us to die for what we believe. But what they believed was not proper. You know, if they're killing, as they were killing the Kuwaitis and taking 40,000, you know, on the other hand, on the other side of their mouth, they're saying that they were seeking peace. And now they're going to blame the United States for wanting to destroy Iraq, and the United States is going against the mandate of the United Nations, which said that they were to free Kuwait. Well, they freed Kuwait. What is that? Do they have any right to go beyond Kuwait? Well, what about the 40,000 Kuwaitis that now live in Iraq against their will? You know, do they have any rights? Well, according to Hussein, they don't. So their wise men will fail them. They will be given advice, Edom will, that is unwise. Undoubtedly, Hussein has gotten unwise advice in all of this. You know, when you got a dictator like that, you got a tyrant and you know he's crazy. It was like Hitler. Hitler had some men around him that wanted to assassinate him. In fact, there was an effort or two to assassinate Hitler. And it backfired and it failed. And then those individuals, some, as I remember the story, even committed suicide and whatever because they knew their life was going to end. They couldn't get to the men. And the others, there were others around him that really wanted him out because they knew that he was destroying the country, but his power was so great. And he did have some on his side and they knew they'd be killed. Just like Hussein killed some of his military advisors and generals because they didn't do it the way he wanted it done. So you're talking about crazy people. Shall I not in that day, says the Eternal, even destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of the Mount of Esau? Point number 7 is their mighty men, their military, would fail them. So the wise men failed them in that they didn't give them proper counsel. Now, finally, point number 7, their mighty men, all these warriors that they think are the great, what, Republican guards? Is that the title that they use there? You know, they're great warriors that they give the greatest munitions to. He said, they're going to fail. Your mighty men, O Teman, which was a main city of Edom, shall be destroyed to the end that every one of the Mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. Every one shall be cut off by slaughter. So the military fails them. Does this mean every one of the Mount of Esau, that all of Edom is absolutely destroyed? Within the context, it would appear the answer is no. When he's talking about everyone here, he is specifically talking about the military, the mighty men, the men of the kingdom, counselors and military, that stand up to battle, that they will all be destroyed. If you look at Jeremiah 49, verse 11, Jeremiah was inspired later. To say that there would be women and children that would be left. So it's not a destruction of the entire nation, not a nuclear bomb that then kills them all. 49 verse 11, leave your fatherless children and I will preserve them alive. Let your widows trust in me. So we see a prophecy of a destruction that is so great that the military, that the men of the country are destroyed, so that you have an overwhelming number of fatherless and of widows. So you should be able to tie Jeremiah 49:11. You can go back and read through Jeremiah 49. It is a prophecy of the destruction of Edom. And of course that one was stated after the fall of Jerusalem. The one in Jeremiah 49, that is. Okay, verse 10 then, we talk about the covenant of brotherhood. For your violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, you shall be cut off forever. Deuteronomy 2, verse 4. Deuteronomy 2 and verse 4, let me read that. And command you the people, saying, you are to pass through the coast of your brother, your brethren, the children of Esau, which dwell in Seir, and they shall be afraid of you. Take you good heed, therefore, yourselves. Meddle not with them, for I will not give you their land, no, not so much as a foot breadth, because I have given Mount Seir unto Esau for a possession. So they had been warned as they came in that there were to be brothers. Jacob was to be a brother to Esau, not to take of their land, not to stay there, but just to pass through it. Deuteronomy 23 and verse 7. Now, since God did this for Esau, Esau should have realized that God was going to expect the same thing out of them in their attitude towards Jacob. 23 verse 7. You shall not abhor an Edomite. He is your brother. You know, we need to be careful even in our attitudes towards Arabs, you know, this being the latest battle and infringement, I guess, upon rights. And, I would hope that we would empathize with the Arab world and the pain and suffering they're going through because of the few. You know, I don't believe that all Iraqis want to see everybody else dead in the world. But when you get a leader that stirs them up, for the most part, those at least non-military, they would like to have peace also. And then they get caught up in the lies that they're told by leadership. You shall not abhor an Edomite. He is your brother. You shall not abhor an Egyptian because you were a stranger in his land. The children that are begotten of them shall enter into the congregation of the Eternal in their third generation. So he said, as they obey God and they commit themselves to God, then in their third generation they would be omitted into the very congregation of God. So this contrasts then the attitude of Edom. He did not appreciate what God had done for Edom. Verse 11, of that day, or in the day that you stood on the other side, or in opposition, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and the foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even you were as one of them, was saying that they were part of that military force, and there were many that were a part of the military when Jerusalem was taken. Nebuchadnezzar, according to historical accounts, had Edomites in his army, and Ezekiel 36, verse 5, talks about the Edomites moving into parts of Judah, even though the main populace of Edom stayed in the Edomite countries in the land of Seir. I think this is a quote that I got from Langer's Encyclopedia of History, 586 to 538, the Jews under Babylonian rule. In Judea, the Jews were poor and hard-pressed between the Edomites and the Samaritans. You know, the Samaritans were in the north, Edomites in the south, and they were very poor. They were oppressed. In Babylon, they were prosperous and progressive, which helps to understand why so few came back from Babylon. They heard the stories of what was happening back in Palestine. There were some, 42,000 is the number that comes to mind. I think maybe we look at that when we get down to Ezra. But there was, really a handful, comparatively, that came out of Babylon to come back to the Promised Land. Part of it was because of how they'd been treated by Edomites and by Samaritans. Verse 12, through 14, a lot of times prophetic verses are dual, and we would view this as dual. You should not have looked on the day of your brother in the day that he became a stranger. The day, in other words, that he was taken captive, you shouldn't have looked with glee, joyful, that he's getting his or we're getting even now because of what he did to me.